I'd like to welcome you all to CSIS this morning, for this morning's session. Those of you who are regulars know that we've been hosting a series of events that have been focusing to some extent on the Mexican federal elections, whether it's focus on political parties. We had an event that focused on the military, or so it's a focus either on important sectors heading into the election or political analysis focused. This morning's session, I think, is an interesting one. Obviously, Mexico's economic outlook going into the elections is important. In drafting the letter of invitation, though, I thought, you know what? Mexico has improved a lot in terms of its economic fundamentals, and hopefully I won't be contradicted by the panelists, but it's not like previous presidential elections. In fact, a few years back, we published a book by Jonathan Heath, who is obviously one of the speakers today, called The Sexenio Curse, which dealt with the issue of Mexico's economic crisis during presidential successions. A lot has happened in Mexico, not just politically, but in terms of the management of its own economy. I think there is a lot. There is greater transparency, and as a result, the issue of economic crises during a presidential succession is not as high on the list of concerns as it was a few years back. But what is interesting is that when you look at the Mexican economy, it's not just the election itself, but what comes after the election, which is why I decided to title it Heading into the 2006 Elections and Beyond, because there are a lot of issues affecting that the next administration and the next Mexican Congress are going to have to address from an economic standpoint, from a structural reform standpoint, that will have an impact on Mexico's economic outlook during the mid to long term. And unfortunately, there are many vital issues that are going to have to be addressed, a lot of very difficult decisions that are going to have to be made during the next 6-year term, both for the administration and for the Congress. This morning's session, we've invited, there's four renowned economists. I'm going to make a brief introduction. We were supposed to be hosting Alberto Gomez, the chief economist from Banamex, and unfortunately at the last minute, he was not able to come. When I had actually invited him, I had been forewarned that he's a very difficult guy to get, because the CEO of Banamex relies on him considerably, and his agenda is tied to the CEO's. And so, nonetheless, we extended an invitation. He accepted at the last minute. The CEO needed him to stay behind. But this is not to say that we don't have someone from Banamex and someone who is highly qualified and who both Sydney and I know and are delighted that he was able to join us. So it is kind of out of order alphabetically, but I wanted to make that comment in terms of Alberto's absence. We are honored to have Sergio Luna here, who you all have the bio. He's a vice president in the Department of Economic and Sociopolitical Research at Banamex, has been there since 1987, is highly regarded. Like I said, we've met before. He's been here with us before, although not at an event, and we're delighted that he was able to come at the last minute. I'm sure he had to cancel and move his agenda around and cancel different appointments to be here with us. So Sergio, thank you for coming. The other person that we invited is Mario Rodarte Esquivel. Mario, we decided to invite Mario obviously because he's highly regarded in his field. He's the chief economist for the Center for Economic Studies of the Private Sector. And we thought that it would be interesting to the discussion to have somebody who is closely linked to the Mexican private sector, their concerns over the Mexican economy, and to some extent capture their perspective through someone who interacts with them regularly on economic issues. He's also a professor of economics at the Universidad Panamericana, and has written extensively. And Mario, we're delighted to have you here. This is the first time that you're here at CSIS. We met for the first time, I think it was a year ago, at the Four Seasons at a reception, and it took me 12 months to get you here, but we got you here. So we're delighted that you're here with us. Jonathan Heath is no stranger to CSIS. He's an adjunct fellow of ours. I love working with him. The times that we've commissioned him to write something, he submits his drafts in a timely fashion and very well written, and that's something that I treasure, because it's not as frequent as I would like. But he's highly regarded in his field as well. He recently joined HSBC and is the head of research and the chief economist for Mexico for HSBC. He decided to finally leave. It was independent consultant to some extent. And so I was kidding him earlier, saying that now he has to answer to the man. But he seems very happy, and we're delighted that he's here with us. He has written for us in the past, and hopefully we'll get him to write for us in the future. I left Sidney Weintraub last because I figured he's part of the family. And also, you know, from an alphabetical standpoint, he should go last, I guess. But Sidney is someone who I'm very fond of. He is someone who, all you know, is highly regarded economist, writes probably more than anybody that I know, and writes with such ease that it's actually somewhat mind-boggling. He's the William E. Simon Chair here at CSIS, and is been busy working on a book on energy in the hemisphere, but still follows economic issues very closely. So Sidney, I'm glad that you're able to join us, even though you only had to come down a few floors to be with us. But I'm delighted that you're here. I think it should be an interesting discussion. For those of you who come to these sessions, know that we like for them to be very interactive, try to limit the formality and you know, people presenting written text. We want it to be a little bit more interactive, more informal. We do have, Sergio Luna did prepare a PowerPoint, which we're not going to use in order to kind of keep this interactive format. But we are going to be posting it on our web page. There's going to be a write-up for this event, and I would encourage you all to go to the website and to look at the PowerPoint that he prepared along with Alberto Gomez for today's session. I think it would be useful for you all. Jonathan, I think we said that we would start with Mario, and the way it's going to work, Mario's going to start. He's going to make, you know, probably a 10-minute remark, and then we're going to go around, then Jonathan, then Sergio, and then Sidney, and basically comment on what's been said, and we're going to go around a few times. There obviously are knowledgeable individuals sitting at the table or sitting at the back, and at one point in the session, we're going to start turning to those people sitting around the table and those sitting on the periphery to also engage them in the discussion and have it be interactive. But also, I would like for the issues of those that are in attendance to be addressed and engage them in the discussion as well. So this is supposed to be a fun, interactive session, which will be, I think, very interesting. The last session that we had was with Luis Carlos Ugalde, the president of the IFE, and it was, I think, a very good session with a lot of information that came out of it, and I anticipate that this morning's session will also be, I think, very productive for us who are focusing on the Mexican election and to some extent Mexico's economic outlook, not just heading into this election, but beyond. Having said that, why don't I turn the microphone over to Mario and we can get started.
Thank you, Armand. Well, I would begin to say that the Mexican economy is in a reasonable good shape right now, and having the lowest country risk in ever, it's a good sensation in Mexico, and enjoying also low inflation and also the benefits of a mostly developed capital market is a very good thing to happen. However, there are some issues behind this stability recently reached in Mexico. One has to do with the rate of growth of our economy, which is a little higher than 3% a year. And the good thing about this 3% is a sustainable rate, but the bad thing is that we need this rate of growth to be higher in order to accomplish several goals related to the benefits for the whole society. This rate of growth has been accompanied by a generation of employment, mostly in the informal sector. But this informality has to do a lot with the conditions in the labor market, where probably you know that our labor market is highly inflexible, and this is causing that most of the new jobs are going basically in the informal sector. And also behind this rate of growth of the economy, we have an industry which is has a contrast between the manufacturing sector, which is growing very slowly, mainly because the automobile industry is being affected by the conditions that the American economy is facing in the automobile industry, and also the conditions of the final demand in the United States also affect the growth of manufacturing in Mexico. However, the other side in this industrial sector in Mexico has to do with the maquiladora industry, which is really growing fast at a rate above 10% a year, and also generating a lot of employment. This is formal employment, and this is really producing something like an equilibrium in the industry. But the most dynamic sector in our economy has to do with services. Services mainly impulsed by retail sales, which are having the benefit of large growth in employment, on also the higher purchasing power of salaries. Real salaries are growing fast, and also we have a good purchasing conditions in our economy. The automobile industry, which in terms of the sales in the domestic market are really growing fast, and also with the tourism sector, which is, receives the benefits of the domestic market with a higher purchasing power in the domestic market, and also a large segment of foreigner visitors to our economy. We, as you know, we benefited from the fact of the terrorism beginning quite a few years ago, and also we some redirection of the flow of tourism in the world. We have been receiving a lot of tourism. Also, this impulse of the touristic industry is pushing the restaurants and hotels industry in Mexico, which is also facing a high rate of growth. And related to this, transportation is really having a good impulse in our economy. Also, transportation is growing, receiving the benefit of export and import economy. And as I say before, local transportation is really growing well. On the side of the financial services, we have a fast-growing banking industry accompanied by the insurance industry, which is really facing a good future. Investment funds are something relatively new in our economy and receiving a lot of a good drive from the higher purchasing power in the domestic market, also a lot of foreigners investing in our economy. And also the industry related to the issuance of debt and shares in the local market has also generating a lot of good business in Mexico. On the side of the agricultural sector, we have seen also very stable growth. As probably as you know, our agricultural sector is also polarized. We have a low productivity sector, which has been that way for the last, I would say, 400 years. But also we have the highly productive sector, which is mainly focused on the export industry, and they are very investing well, they're producing well, and they're selling well. And this generates exports, I would say, roughly $5 billion a year, and it's been growing well. In the last quarter, for example, the agricultural sector in Mexico reached a rate of growth of higher than 10%, which is very good. And this agricultural sector has been experiencing some drive from the domestic market with high purchasing power, and also from steady exports to the whole world. And this growing framework has been generating some good conditions, as I said before, in the labor market, which is mainly pushed by maquiladoras and construction, and a little bit from retail sales. This generates formal jobs in the economy. And also the services, the whole services sector is generating mostly informal jobs. But low inflation and stable interest rates, and also a very predictable exchange rate, are among the things that are behind these good conditions of our economy. However, there are several issues behind this stability and this growth. One of these issues is what's behind the public balance. Well, you know, we have well-balanced public finances, and there is a very low economic deficit. But what's behind? I would say the big issue is oil revenues, which our government hasn't been able to put on the table what is the solution to be discussed. The other thing is has to do with we have among the lowest tax revenues in the world, which is another thing that has to be solved, because what is causing this combination of high oil revenues and low tax revenues is that the taxes that we have are very distorting and causing a lot of trouble for industries and also for families. The other thing is that has to be faced, or the other issue, and I will leave this for my colleagues here to comment, is if the 3% inflation is sustainable. From my point of view, it is not, but we are going to discuss this later on. Also, the current account has been behaving nicely. We don't have any trouble, neither from the point of view of the amount of the size of the deficit, the current account deficit, nor from the point of view of the financing this deficit. Probably you remember 10 years ago, our economy was struggled by the deficit, the current account deficit, but not only that, the size was close to 7% of GDP. The other problem was that we were unable to find the funds to finance this deficit, and that's why our economy went into a big trouble. The other thing is how long our economy can survive with a very low rate of investment that we are seeing today, and also when the labor market is finally reached equilibrium between the creation of jobs in the formal market and the informal market. You know, there is a trend to translate formal jobs to the informal economy, because firms are facing that it's very inexpensive to hire workers in the informal conditions. But this has to reach an equilibrium, because otherwise the social effects are very could be very nasty. Also, the other thing behind this nice behaved economy has to do with public pension funds. Probably you know that our system privatized the pension funds for workers going to the private sector, but public workers, which include government, federal government, local government, and public universities, and the army, and they are not private funds, and mostly these public funds are broke, and they might cause a big hole in the public finances in the future. The other thing that I would like to mention has to do with the illegal economy. How long are we going to allow it to grow, and what are going to be the effects on the rest of our economy? And the other thing is how can improve can we improve NAFTA? And not from the point of view of putting NAFTA to revision, just to review it, but also, I would say, we have to get the most of the benefits from this agreement, which from my point of view, we haven't been able to get all the benefits of this agreement. The other thing has to do with migration, and in a world, I would say, and I would finish with this, what is going to happen with competitiveness in our economy? That's the big issue. We are growing, but with a very low rate of investment. We are generating jobs, but mostly in the informal economy. We have stable public finances, but how long is going to be this condition? And this, I believe, has to do with competitiveness. All the components of competitiveness are really in an issue. I would say not only public services and government services, but also what it has to do with in entrepreneurial capacity of in our economy is very questionable. And I would say I will finish with this and leave the rest to Jonathan.
Well, Mario, you actually put a lot on the table that I'm sure we're going to go back to. But Jonathan.
Well, I think Mario addressed most of the, put more emphasis on kind of the real side of the economy. And I'll address my first comments more on the central bank's role in Mexico, and I think that it's one of the main achievements or things that has changed in the Mexican economy over the last 10 years. If you remember, the central bank gained its autonomy on the 1st of April of 1994, and we've now 11 and a half years of autonomy. It started out quite shaky. If you remember, just about 10 days before the central bank gained its autonomy, Donaldo Colosio was assassinated back in 94. And in April of 94, there was a roughly about $10 billion flight of capital just in that 1 month. And the central bank was blamed for the way it handled all the monetary policy in 94. And regardless of whether it was correct or wrong in doing so, I think that the main point here is it started out kind of on a very shaky start. But since then, I think that it's probably one of the institutions that has advanced the most, and today has probably the highest credibility of them all. I would put it way above even the Instituto Federal Electoral, the IFE. And I would place the central bank right now as probably the best example of a truly autonomous, strong branch within Mexican institutions, which really stands out because probably one of our weakest point is precisely the general overall weakness of institutions in Mexico. Monetary policy, I think, has done very, very well. If you remember, inflation was coming down at a pretty good pace in the early 90s, but it was using the exchange rate as an anchor, and that was criticized at that moment, and then everything kind of exploded, and back then, and inflation finished in 1995 at 52%. Well, then it's been going down gradually, and right now, in the month of October, it's at 3.05, basically 3.1%. In fact, it at about just much nearer to 3% if we use the 15-day index instead of the monthly index. And this is the lowest inflation that Mexico's had since 69. And also, right now, our headline inflation, our year-over-year headline inflation, is actually even below the U.S. inflation. And that's also first for the last, I think, 34, 35 years also. And even though we do expect a seasonal rebound in December and in January, and the headline will probably go slightly back up maybe 3.5% or so, the fact is that this year inflation will end closer to 3 than to 4. And I do think that we can sustain the 3% or close to the 3% target over the years. I mean, obviously, it'll depend on quite a few things. This will be a point of discussion. But I think it's one of the things that has really helped Mexico, and it's behind almost all of the other things that Mexico has been able to do. Because of the fact that inflation has come down and everybody believes it's going to stay down, we've been able to develop, and we're the only Latin American country with a long-term fixed-rate bond market. We now have 3, 5, 7, 10, and 20-year fixed-rate bonds, which very few emerging markets can say that they have. In fact, the finance ministry is thinking about maybe even coming out with a 30-year bond. Whether they do it or not, I don't know, but at least they're toying with the idea. So, I mean, to talk about having a 30-year bond and think that there's going to be a market for it, I think is enough proof from my point of view that not only has the central bank been able to achieve its targets or bring the inflation down very near to its targets, but that there's enough credibility out there that inflation will stay low for in the future to be able to have these bonds. Another thing I think that has been very, very helpful for the central bank and has really helped not only gain this credibility that is very important for any central bank is the fact that it started its transition towards inflation targeting, I think started in 99 or somewhere around there, and formally adopted inflation targeting in 2001, 2002. I remember that when the central bank celebrated its 75th anniversary in 2000, there was a lot of people talking about inflation targeting back then, and there was about, I think, 8 or 9 countries that had already adopted it. And now the central bank celebrated its 80th anniversary, and there's now well over 20-something countries, including not only just Great Britain, Canada, Australia, but also a pretty good number of emerging market countries. And I think that everybody has been really thrilled with the success of inflation targeting. And the most important thing that it's done for Mexico is it's a regime that guarantees or that gives transparency and especially accountability in terms of monetary policy. We have now at least 5 years of quarterly inflation reports, which are very, very good, explain exactly what the central bank is thinking, where the risks are, and so we know, I think, pretty well where the intentions are. And then maybe one other thing that I think it helped Mexico a lot at the beginning, but now it's probably coming towards a time where we can, well, I think we've already started the transition, leaving the corto instrument behind and now going towards interest rate targeting. I think that's we're already pretty much along in that transition, and I think it's just a matter of the central bank admitting formally that it's already doing that, and I think that's just somewhere very soon. And I think that's also something that has added even another piece of this transparency of knowing where the central bank, what it's doing, et cetera. And I think that trying to second guess, I think, where and what monetary policy is doing is pretty much a thing of the past. I think the central bank was very aggressive. It showed that its intentions of keeping inflation down were very, very serious. It brought the overnight rate from roughly about 4 to 9.75, that's almost 575 basis points increase over a 2-year period. I mean, really indicating that it was really serious. It wanted to avoid the kind of the contagion effect first of supply shocks that had hit the headline in rate, wanted to avoid the core inflation rate going up, and I think it was very successful in doing that. And then it wanted to kind of bring the inertia where core inflation was roughly staying around between 3.6, 3.8, wanted to bring it down. Core inflation is now at about 3.1. It's the lowest that we've ever had ever since core inflation has been registered. And I think that the achievements here have been very, very remarkable. Not only that, but another thing I think that shows how mature Mexican monetary policy is that starting in August, the central bank has been edging the overnight rate back down again, and it's been doing it at a measured pace, borrowing the word here from Greenspan's vocabulary, at a 25 basis point reduction per month. But not only that, but it's going in the opposite direction of U.S. monetary policy, where U.S. monetary policy right now is increasing its rates. So the fact that the Mexican central bank can lower when the U.S. is increasing and not having any distortion or any major problem, I think is also another very good sign of maturity. And another thing I think that has really helped is that with lower inflation, the pass-through from your exchange rate movements into inflation, which in Mexico is probably one of the highest in the world, has virtually, I wouldn't say disappeared, but definitely gone down dramatically. And right now, we have a very successful floating exchange rate with very little pass-through, if any, into the inflation rate, so that the exchange rate can float, and the fear of floating, I think, in Mexico is pretty much gone. And I think that they've done a very good job in managing this. With this, I think that even though we will see this seasonal rebound in inflation over the next couple of months, I think that we still will be able to maintain inflation on a regular basis between the plus minus 1% range around the 3% target. We may occasionally see a slight deviation from that given supply shocks, but I think that the central bank is showing that they're very capable of managing that. This is, I think, central to the fact that we have, as Mario said, the best country risk rating that we've ever had. And I think it's directly related to this stability, macroeconomic stability, that the central bank has given us. Even though the short-term interest rates went up 570 basis points, if you look at the medium-longer-term interest rates, they didn't go up. In fact, they even edged down there for a while, and we had an inverted yield curve, which is really remarkable because it shows that there is credibility that inflation over the medium-long term is going to remain very near 3%. And I think that's also another very clear sign of maturity and of credibility and the belief that the central bank is going to maintain and is serious about maintaining stability. And I think that this gives us a very good outlook in terms of the macroeconomic stability, especially going into the last year of the sexenio. As you all know, has always been a very important year for Mexico. So kind of my last here comments is just, okay, well, with this outlook and with this strength of the central bank, which I think is the backbone right now of Mexican macroeconomic stability, what can happen or what are the political implications of going into next year? I think that even if we do have a lot of political noise, I think right now, I think any one of the three leading candidates has a chance of winning the elections. In fact, we could even see a scenario with almost a three-way tie. I mean, it's possible. A lot of the political analysts think that one of the three will kind of fall into a distant third, and it'll be a race for two. But it could very, very well be a race for three. And even with a very tight political scenario, I think that we won't see very much of a contagion effect into financial markets. We could see a little bit of nervousness in the exchange rate, but I don't think it'll be anything of any consequence. I don't think anybody will really be too nervous about it. I don't think we'll see any type of capital flights or anything like that at all. I mean, I think it'll be a relatively stable environment. And the only thing, excuse me, I think that we would probably have to maybe worry a little more about is if one of the three candidates, and I don't want to talk bad about him because Manuel is here and he's Manuel speaks very highly of this person. He's given him prizes in the past, a lot of prizes. you should go back and keep giving him prizes. But I'm sure that Manuel will be able to give us his views on that. But I think that the one candidate, I think you're all knowing who we're talking about, is the one that I think has a few more people worried. And what could happen? I mean, is he somebody who could be crazy like Chavez, or even worse, which a few people think that he's very capable of doing that? Or is he somebody who would, at the end of the day, kind of roughly maybe still talk with this left rhetoric, but maybe edge more towards the center? At the end of the day, I mean, I think there are people who really do think that that is what he would do if he was elected. And I think that a couple of the things that we have to look at the very beginning is that if he does win the elections, obviously the first thing that we're all going to be interested in is who is he going to appoint as his finance minister. And I think that is going to be the probably one of the most important signs. But then don't forget that 1 month into the new presidency, on the 31st of December of 2006, the first deputy governor finishes his term. And if I remember right, I think it's Jesus Marcos. And I think that a very important sign is going to be who fills that post. I think that if let's say López Obrador wins and he affirms or gives Jesús Marcos, for example, another term, it would be an extremely powerful sign that that he's going to let the central bank continue to do its job. Could López Obrador screw up the central bank's autonomy? Potentially, yes. Not immediately, but over time. He would have the first deputy governor maybe in 1 month, then the second deputy governor two years later, and then the governor would be replaced exactly halfway through his term. So exactly halfway through his term, he could have potentially 3 out of 5 votes. Now, Jonathan, is it possible and would he want to do that?
Let me ask you a question, and sorry to interrupt. In the case of the central bank governor, it's nominated by the president.
That's where I was
and
going.
And it goes through the Senate.
Exactly. That's
is it the same for the deputies? Or
yes.
So he would still require for the Senate.
Yes, that's exactly where I was going. One thing I was going to say was, could he do this that easily? First of all, the Constitution says that any of the governor or the deputy governor has to have experience in the field. So theoretically, he couldn't name, for example, Madrid Bartres or somebody like that to be on the board of the Bank of Mexico. So that kind of eliminates a good part of you know, like René Bejarán or those types of people. So that's kind of a good first step. The second part there is that the Senate would have to approve the nomination, and that's also another kind of these counterbalances. What I think a lot of people are scared about with López Obrador is that is sometimes he seems to disregard these types of things, and he's willing to somehow or other figure out how to appoint somebody in the central bank, in spite of what the Senate says. And he always seems to kind of go against those types of things if it goes against him. And that's, I think, where we could be a little more scared. But I do think that there's enough, first of all, balances and counterbalances there in counterweights in place. And then second of all, I really truly do not think, maybe Manuel won't agree with me, I'm not too sure, but I do not think that López Obrador would want to screw up the central bank autonomy. I think he's willing to do a lot of other stupid things, but not that. I think that he understands that in stability, macroeconomic stability in Mexico is definitely a plus. And I truly think that he'll want to keep that in spite of a lot of other things that he would be doing. So I think that's kind of the key question. And then with the 3%, roughly 3% plus minus one, is it sustainable? I think it is. Obviously, there's the López Obrador threat, and he could try and screw it up. But I don't think he would try. And then if he tries to, I think that he could be pretty much counterbalanced enough to kind of keep it in place. So I do think that there is a very, very good future for macroeconomic stability in Mexico in the year 2000 and after.
Jonathan, thank you very much. Sergio.
Thank you. Thank you, and good morning to everybody. I think now we have a lot of comments both from Mario and Jonathan, and it is difficult to think on what things to focus, so I will probably focus on a little bit of politics. Probably I will just sum up in the comments of Mario and Jonathan, in the sense that in terms of growth, we are going to have a rate of growth of approximately 3% in the next few years. There has been some change in terms of the engines of growth in the Mexican economy, with the internal market playing a more important role than the export market. That's different from the first 10 years of the NAFTA. So we have this change of engine, but nevertheless, in terms of year, we are still at the same rate of 3%, still disappointing in terms of the rate of growth that we need for the country. So that's a major issue, and probably I will add that in that respect, it is not clear how to achieve a higher rate of growth for the Mexican economy. So that's a major issue that somehow is not present in the current discussion, in the current political discussion about how to achieve higher rate of growth. There seems to be some agreement among all the participants in the political debate on the importance of stability. That goes very much towards what Jonathan was saying, that unless it is absolutely necessary, there is a commitment to stability, but nevertheless, it's not clear how to achieve higher rates of growth. So we have that situation in terms of the real side of the economy, in terms of financial conditions. We have what I could call an extra mile given by the current conditions in the global market. We have seen that interest rates have been going up in the U.S., but nevertheless, in terms of emerging markets, there is still not an effect of fewer liquidity, and that is allowing Mexico to enter 2006 in a better position that we were expecting before, basically because as the central bank starts monetary easing, there hasn't been any effect in terms of seeing fewer supply of funds for Mexico. So basically, the decision of the central bank of going towards easing in monetary policy via these cuts in interest rates is not having any impact in terms of for example, the exchange rate. The exchange rate is going to enter 2006 as a very strong level. Increasingly, it is difficult to convince investors on why we are seeing an exchange rate that by the end of 2006 is going to be at 11.3 pesos per dollar. That implies that starting with the current levels of exchange rate, we will have to see a very important nominal depreciation, and simply there are no reasons to expect that when we look at the fundamentals and when we look at the position at which the economy is entering the year. So basically, that's the framework in which we're going to start the year, very stable conditions in the macroeconomic front, the rate of growth that is, although not the one that we need, is reasonable enough with a higher participation of the internal market in that rate of growth. And that's sort of the framework in which political campaigns are going to start. As you all know, we had sort of a poll war in the last few weeks. Between the end of October and the beginning of November, approximately 9-10 polls have been made on the presidential race. So for practical purposes, even though the campaigns are formally starting in January, we're already in the stage in which commentators are concentrating on the candidates. I'm told by a pollster that actually it wasn't the ideal conditions to try to see electoral preferences the last few weeks, basically because we have many minor shocks and therefore we have a lot of volatility in the polls. But nevertheless, it seems that that's one of the reasons why we have still a lot of very different results depending on which poll you see. For example, when you look at the poll of Milenio, which gives López Obrador 39 points, that's a difference of 10 points vis-a-vis the second contender, which in the case of this poll is still Mr. Madrazo, whereas in the case of Reforma, the poll that was released recently, a week ago, Mr. López Obrador has 33 percentage points vis-a-vis 32 for Mr. Calderón from the PAN, so that's basically a virtual tie between these two candidates. And you see a lot of volatility between all these results. There is a poll war about how reliable are all these estimates. We believe that probably there are three main conclusions that can be established at this stage, and considering that we have a lot of volatility. First of all, AMLO is losing steam. López Obrador is losing steam. Now, when he was the sole contender at the polls, he was higher. Now it seems that with competition, with the definition of candidates by the other two, leading political parties, the difference is narrowing down. Second, there is this issue of the impact that the selection process at the PRI, all these internal struggles and corruptions, scandals, what was the impact in terms of the possibilities of Mr. Madrazo? And that is not clear, that so far we haven't seen the impact of that reflected on the polls. In some surveys, in some polls, certainly there is a decline of Mr. Madrazo, actually becoming third place rather than second place. But in some others, it is not that clear. So that's probably a conclusion that cannot be reached at this stage. What is true is that in the case of the PAN, the nomination of Mr. Calderon seems to have increased the odds of the PAN. There has been a revival in the preferences for the National Action Party. And in that sense, what all these polls says is that, as Jonathan was mentioning, we are going to start January with three candidates, with a three-way race. Probably I will elaborate a little bit on this opinion among political analysts in Mexico, in the sense that at some point, these three candidates with equal possibilities to win the presidency are going to become a two-way contest rather than a three-way contest, a famous parejera in Mexico, a two-way contest. And the reason for that is that I believe that most analysts bet on the fact that we're going to see some sort of a strategic vote. At some point during the contest, voters will have to choose between that candidate that probably is not their first option, but that nevertheless they will try to vote against the candidate that they don't like. And in that sense, if we go into this two-way contest, it is very likely that what we are going to see is Mr. López Obrador as one of the contenders, and the second post being decided between Mr. Calderón and Mr. Madrazo. So that would be the configuration of the two-way race towards the presidency. Of course, in the process, and given that we are going to have a very close contest, it is very likely that we are going to see scandals, really, really difficult, really tough political campaigning, particularly as those places are defined. And in that respect, certainly there is a concern about how much of this very strong competition, how much of an impact it can have on the macroeconomic front. And in that respect, it is usually, I mean, the comparison we have seen a lot has been with the situation in Brazil when Lula was in competition to become the president. And I think that the reason why this comparison has been made has to do with the fact that there is the idea that if López Obrador is the leading contender in the polls, what we are trying to measure here is how the markets are going to react to the possibility of a left-wing candidate winning the presidency in Mexico. That is, by the way, the only point of resemblance that I see between Mexico and Brazil, because we have to remember that in the case of the Brazilian situation, it was above all a problem of debt dynamics. That's an important issue. I mean, the way in which we saw the reaction of financial variables in Brazil was certainly linked to the fact that that markets were doubtful about how a Lula presidency would go. But even if Serra would have been the winner, there was a problem of the dynamics that needed to be solved in the case of Brazil. And that's an important difference between the situation of Brazil and the situation in Mexico. In Mexico, as Jonathan said, we have very strong fundamentals. There is a major difference in debt management and, of course, in the composition of financial inflows. So in that respect, I think that the comparison with Brazil is not very valid to think about what could happen in terms of potential volatility in Mexico in 2006. Basically, because in Brazil, it was an economic problem or a financial problem that was complicated by political situation, whereas in the case of Mexico, what we're talking about is basically a political situation. I believe that the major risks there are not in terms of economic or financial variables, but actually that the risk factors are in the political scene. And I would say that probably the factors that we have to look in that respect have to do with with the role that the political authorities are going to play, not only the IFE, the Electoral Institute, but also the Electoral Tribunal. That's an important component that should be considered. We have to think that in 2005 we had some very contested elections in at the state level in cases such as Oaxaca or Veracruz, and we didn't see any action by the Electoral Tribunal. So that is creating a precedence in the sense that to some extent, and making the comparison with the soccer game, which we always do in Mexico, at the moment that the arbiter is not using the yellow or the red card to penalize four plays, that is sending a message in the sense that probably you can spend more than you are allowed to in the next presidential, in the next campaign, and the next campaign is the presidential campaign. So there is a problem in terms of, there is a risk in terms of electoral authorities, and that is linked to the possibility of seeing a lot of money being spent on campaigns, which illegal money, even considering into this scenario. So I think those two risks are far more important than the kind of risk that we can see in the macroeconomic sphere. There is therefore, in terms of short-term impacts for the economic front, I think that we are going to see limit impacts there. If they happen, I think that the instrument that the authorities are going to use is mostly the exchange rate rather than the interest rate. It has to do with a point that was mentioned before, and that's that as Mexico is moving towards an inflation target policy, you prefer to use the exchange rate in order to deal with volatility, in order to try to keep a stable interest rate, so to prepare the road towards completing the transition towards the inflation targeting policy, which I believe is going to be till 2007. I think that the central bank is going to be quite conservative, and even if the corto, the short, is a relic under the new system, they would prefer not to move anything and wait till 2007 to do changes, following Yogi Berra's advice, if ain't broken, don't fix it. So in that sense, I think that the major issues in terms of how much of a crossroad 2006 is going to be have to do with the changes in terms of economic policy in the medium term. And the important thing there is to think about the checks and balances, something that was mentioned by Jonathan as well, in the sense of a theory which I call the Mexico is not Venezuela theory, which is very very common in Mexico nowadays. We like to think, well, even if Mr. López Obrador becomes the president, there is a lot of institutional check and balances. There's of course the central bank, there's the electoral authority, there's the role of Congress, and so on and so forth. But we have seen some interesting trend in the polls recently, and that's different from the 2000 campaign in the sense that it seems that the composition of Congress is also going to be influenced by the decision by the choices of presidential candidates. For example, in the case of the PRD, we saw an increase in electoral preferences for Congress, for the PRD, which was linked to the popularity of Mr. López Obrador. That is, preferences for the PRD at Congress were higher than the historical proportion that the PRD usually has got in Congress. And more importantly is that the recent revival of fortunes for the PAN linked to the nomination of Mr. Calderon has also been linked to an increase in the chances of the PAN in Congress. So I would say that the major premise that is behind the Mexico is not Venezuela theory has to do with the fact that we are assuming that whoever wins the presidency, bar the PRI probably, he's not going to have a majority in Congress. But it is important to consider that that's a premise. That's that because that's probably the major assumption behind this Mexico's not Venezuela theory. We could have therefore a different configuration, and I think that it's still too early to tell what is going to be the composition of Congress. But that is going to be an important factor, and a factor that has to be taken into consideration. Moreover, we have to think that beyond 2006. As we focus almost exclusively on the presidential campaigns, the parties are running important risk in terms of the composition they're going to have in Congress. So I think that even though, for example, upon losing the presidential contest, will manage to stick together in Congress as a coherent party. But I'm not sure that the same conclusion can be applied either to the PRI or to the PRD. So even though, independently of what is the composition of Congress, it is important to think how coordinated parties can work in Congress in the 2006 and beyond. And that is going to be an important issue as well in terms of governability. I think rather than thinking that the risk can go in just one direction, in the sense of having a strong president imposing his will on Congress, I think that we can have also the opposite situation of a Congress that is in disarray, that in which parties are having fewer capacity to have control over the different factions of represented in Congress, and therefore very much like the situation we saw during this Mr. Fox's administration, which is that although we have some idea of what we want to achieve in terms of, for example, the structural reforms, they are not the institutional conduits in order to achieve the kind of consensus that is required for those achievements. By the way, and I will just finish with that, something, and that goes back to something that Mario was mentioning, is that so far the debate doesn't make clear how each of these candidates will try to articulate a vision of stability plus growth. Growth is going to be an important issue in the elections, but for the moment being, we don't see any articulate sort of grand vision, strategic vision about how to achieve all these things. It's sort of a piecemeal approach to structural reforms. Let's reform one over another, but there is no clear strategy on how each of these candidates are going to reform. If force, I would say that probably the one who has a better vision of what he wants to achieve is Mr. López Obrador, even though there are important inconsistencies. But nevertheless, in terms of the coherence of the message, I think that he's probably the most coherent one. So that's probably a very sad conclusion in the sense that we know that we need to grow faster, but it's not clear how each of these candidates are instrumenting a vision in order to achieve that goal. With that, I will stop.
Sergio, thank you very much. Before I go to Sydney, I'd like to make two very quick points on something that you said. You made a point over the possibility of there being strategic voting, making it from a three-horse to a two-horse race. I actually think that the point that you ended up with, focus on the Congress, I think eliminates the viability of strategic voting. I think none of the parties are going to compromise their quota in Congress in exchange for a presidential election outcome that may be more desirable for the nation. I don't think any political party would put the nation's fate before their own political party survival. So I think that's one of the points I wanted to make. The other point that I want to make, which I think is important in terms of the composition of Congress, I think that, you know, the parties have, depending on whether it's the chamber of or the Senate, they have until either the first 2 weeks in March or the first 2 weeks in April to come up with their list of candidates. The political parties, the leaderships are going to be using the lists and the candidacies to broker within intra-party divisions. For me, anyway, it's an important benchmark for analysts to focus on, because at the end of the day, those lists will tell you two things. One is, to what extent were they able to reconcile intra-party divisions? And that's in the short term. On the long term, going back to what this actually means for companies and for Mexico, is that you could conceivably end up, a party could conceivably end up with a composition of Congress that is not, or could end up with a faction in Congress that is not necessarily loyal to the leadership of the party, because they use the quotas to reconcile intra-party divisions going into the election. It doesn't necessarily guarantee party discipline once they're in Congress. So to me, those, I think, are important variables to focus on, closing on your point on the Congress. Sydney, let's turn to you.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. What you've heard a lot of very, very optimistic and positive commentary about Mexico. And some of them are really justified. I'm talking about the low inflation, the solidity of monetary policy, the power of the central bank. The finance ministry has been very responsible. I agree with all of these things, but yeah, I want to be a little bit like a former chairman of the Federal Reserve System. When William McChesney Martin was chairman of the Federal Reserve, he used to say his role was to pull the punch bowl away when things were going very well. And in a sense, that is one of the roles of a central bank. I'm going to touch a little more on some of the problems which were touched on but not really discussed very much. I want to discuss four problems which were touched on but not very deeply. One is oil and energy policy, oil and gas in particular, electricity generation. Two is GDP growth. Three is migration. And four is structural issues and what's going to happen. Some of them were touched on. Let me talk about oil and gas. I think people around this table know the situation, and I don't have to say too much. Pemex is taxed, 60% of its growth revenue every year. It's lost money in every one of the last 7 years, has no funds except what it can borrow, and it's borrowed to the hills in order to carry out exploration. Reserves now of oil are about 10 or 11 years at current usage, unless they find more. Mexico is not finding any new gas, natural gas, and all of the efforts to beef up Burgos are probably not going to succeed very much because it's a pretty old gas basin. So the question becomes, how is Mexico going to fix, if you want, its oil and gas sectors, which is not a trivial issue. It's one of the central issues that will have to be faced by the next administration. I don't expect the issue to get deep discussion during the campaign. It gets too sensitive. You're going to take outside investment, or you're going to try to get the budget to be able to provide, take a little less money, the finance ministry, take a little less money from Pemex so they can do investment. And I don't think those issues will come up very much in the campaign. But right after the campaign, I suspect that's one of the major issues that the new president will have to face. And it's not easy. It means raising tax collections if you want to maintain Pemex pretty solidly, or it means changing the Constitution. And I don't have to go into that. I think you all know that. It's a rough issue, and it's worth keeping in mind. Sergio Luna did raise the issue in his discussion of the GDP growth. I think Mario did too. 3% is not enough for a developing country like Mexico. It's just not enough. Too much is missing. It can't do very much. They can't even finance the budget they have to. There are shortcomings throughout a good many of the social areas for which you need the budget. If you're going to collect more taxes, you have to have a higher growth rate. If you're going to deal with poverty, and poverty still remains high in Mexico, you can't do it without a good, solid growth rate. And I suspect we ought to pay more attention to what are the necessary steps that Mexico will take so that its norm is not 3% a year, so they can raise its normal GDP rate to 6% a year, with which a lot of these problems can be addressed and be addressed efficiently. And I suspect what you'll get during the campaign are a lot of words about how growth rates are going to be raised, just as Vicente Fox, when he was running, said he's going to have 7% growth a year. And the last time we had 7% was when his predecessor was president. In other words, that's an issue, and I think it's a big issue that has to be faced. A word on migration. I don't know whether United States will pass legislation on immigration. George Bush, President Bush, has been in the Southwest talking about his plan for guest workers. And I suppose guest workers are, fine in a way. But the big problem is not just guest workers. It's also the number of people who are in the United States today without documents. The figure probably is about 11 million, about half of whom are Mexican. And they have to get dealt with. What he's proposing is they be given 3-year temporary worker visas, a second 3-year, leaving everything open after that. And I don't know how well that will go. We're now getting about 500,000 undocumented workers coming in every year. Not just in odd years, every year is now 500,000. So if you have a temporary worker program, unless you're ready in that program to take in the additional 500,000 each year, year in and year out, you're not going to solve that problem, at least as far as the United States is concerned. In other words, it's not a simple issue. The president really hasn't addressed it. The U.S. Congress hasn't addressed it, and the Mexicans have never faced up to it. And I also think Mexico really has to look at the fact that 500,000 of its people are willing to cross desert, other kinds of areas, to live without papers in a foreign country. And I don't know, that issue, it seems to me, must be addressed. It's a deep weakness of the whole Mexican structure. Finally, let me just talk about structural issues. Again, these have been mentioned by the other speakers, but I want to get into them a little bit. Nothing has happened, really, on many of these structural issues. Nothing of importance has happened during this sexennio, and in fact, during other sexennios, for reasons you've all discussed, the difference between the Congress and the executive branch. Also, they're difficult. What I have in mind are things like labor reform, education reform, tax reform, or if you want to call it fiscal reform, of one kind or another, tax collections, energy reform. These are not small issues. These are issues that go to the heart of Mexican economic growth. I'm sure they lower total factor productivity in Mexico quite considerably. That's the view of economists from Banamex who are writing about this issue, and I think it's a legitimate and correct view. Again, I don't know what the candidates are going to say during the campaign about these things. I've actually read at least what they've told Televisa, their positions are, but some of the things they've told Televisa about energy is just garbage. There may be some others where it's better. And again, I think one of the major tasks of the next president after he's elected, working with the Congress, I hope, is to deal with these issues and not keep putting them off. I've asked myself the question, will Mexico, in a sense, be like the United States? I want the United States to deal with our current account deficit and our budget deficit, and I suspect we'll deal with it after the crash. I think Mexico may do exactly the same thing after the crash. What I'm saying is I hope Mexico can be a little bit more anticipatory in its corrective measures than I think we're being. I'll leave it at that.
Sidney, thank you very much for your 4 points of wisdom. One of the things that we haven't talked about, and we can start opening up a little bit back to some of the people that are sitting around the table and in the sides. Sidney talked a little bit about energy reform. So far, nobody has actually mentioned the Bidiregas and how that fits into Mexico's economic outlook, especially tying in the need for continued energy reform and also having the finances to actually finance the reform, the improvements in infrastructure. I wonder if anybody can talk about that, linking the two, and then we can go to Manuel Suarez Mier. Mario?
Probably you know that in the last 5 years, Pemex has been investing a little more than $10 billion a year, mostly coming from PDRegas. PDRegas is scheme, I guess it was invented in Mexico where the government has somebody build some utility plant or some petrochemical or to dwell some oil field. And after the work is finished, the government pays, and this goes to public debt. So during the last 5 years, Pemex has been investing more than $10 billion, which is a really remarkable figure. But it has to be done in some kind of sneak out fashion, whereas nobody has to notice, because otherwise Congress, especially the men at the Senate, they were going to protest against this practice. The other thing that has been done is these contracts that Pemex had designed, but they haven't received any back from Congress and not from the public. But these PDRegas, they amount closely to a little more than $30 billion right now, which is nothing to be really worried about it, provided that in the near future we make something to correct this situation. But I wouldn't say that right now it's a big issue.
Can I follow up? I think that a good part of this, the possibilities of having any type of a possible energy reform, is very tied into a lot of what Sergio was dealing with, and it's what the outcome in Congress is going to be. And that just kind of touching back just a couple things that there's, just to kind of underline, I think, some of these points. In 2000 elections, one of the two things that were very, very important within Fox's victory, and then not only Fox's victory, but how Congress ended up, was these two concepts of what they call the voto útil and the voto diferenciado, the useful vote and a differential vote. The useful vote was exactly what Sergio was talking about, was I hate the PRI, and if I vote for Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas back in 2000, I'm really helping the PRI. So in order to make sure that the PRI doesn't win, I'm gonna make sure my vote is a useful vote, and I'm gonna vote for Fox. So Fox won really mostly on the back of the anti-PRI vote than a pro PAN vote. So one question is, will we have the same type of useful vote, the voto útil, or not? And I think that's kind of one thing. I think that almost all political analysts say that there still might be something of the voto útil, but not as much as it was in 2000. But then the second issue, I think, which is very important, is whether we're going to have the voto diferenciado, and which is whether people vote for the whoever they think it might make the best president, but then they don't vote for the same party. Like, everybody voted for Fox, but they weren't willing to give Fox the majority of Congress because they were afraid of giving anybody a majority in Congress, and whether that is something that's going to continue today or not. Again, the latest polls tell us that the voto diferenciado will probably be less than what it was before, but it'll still, I think, be a major factor. Even though the PRD has picked up a little bit of its vote, the kind of what the polls tell us today is that even if López Obrador won, he would definitely not be anywhere near a majority in Congress. So the outlook, or the most likely outlook, seems that we'll end up with somebody winning with basically an opposition Congress. And I think that under that scenario, any type of a reform, no matter what proposal we get from the winning candidate, is going to have a very, very hard time. And I think that the most likely scenario for energy reform, at least for the next 6 years, is a muddling through scenario with basically no progress at all.
Just a comment on the question of PDRegas, which I think that makes evident that we are reaching the point in which that scheme is no longer the best way of going around in terms of energy reform. I think that illustrates how close we are to the limits. If you look at the figures for balance of payments in terms of indebtedness, there has been a decline in indebtedness in the year from January to September, and the only item which I see that is growing is precisely the PDRegas item, which, by the way, we are not clear why we have that item there. You know, ideally or theoretically, you won't have external indebtedness out of the concept of Pidiregas. Nevertheless, it is up $2.5 billion this year. And that the problem is that the scheme that was seen as a transition, while the process of energy reform and other reforms were set up, is becoming a scheme that is no longer the best option to finance this problem. So I think that it illustrates pretty well on the limitations that the scheme is reaching now.
Yeah, I find it a fascinating issue because it was an interesting scheme to get around not being able to get energy reform, but being able to get the funding to try to finance or at least inject some money into modernizing infrastructure, keeping it off the books. But that's, I think, using, I guess, your Mexico's credit, right, in exchange? Isn't that how it worked?
Probably it's sort of what we think about the Sobonos in 1994, which made a lot of sense when you had a short period of volatility. You're actually sort of short-circuiting in terms of not having access to indebtedness in dollars. So you take the exchange risk. This is similar in terms of productive activity, in the sense that you have limitations, constitutional limitations for investment in activities such as energy. So you are going this other way in terms of trying to achieve that. Makes a lot of sense if this is a transitory situation, but you know, it starts to make less sense if you don't go head on and solve the problems that are behind the reason why you cannot invest there. So I think that it illustrates the limitations of the current situation in terms of the reforms we haven't been achieving. I don't think it is a major problem now, but nevertheless, it is already showing its limitations.
Okay, Manuel.
For personal allusions, as they say in Congress, I'm Manuel Suarez Mier, Chief Economist for Latin America, Bank of America. And I wrote a column for many years in Mexico City Press, and I created a prize for bad economic ideas. And I gave that prize to those that produced the worst economic ideas, and actually my readers were the ones who voted. So I took all the answers and polled all my readers and so on. And Andrés Manuel López Obrador was at the top of all the years in which I did this contest, because he really has very bad economic ideas. So he got the prize. There's a radio commentator in Mexico City who's also infamous for his Gutiérrez Vivó came close second. But you had these marvelous, surrealistic ideas. There was a governor of Tlaxcala who offered to readopt barter instead of using currency, and that way he thought he would really get more leverage. And you know, it went back to the pre-colonial traditions and so on and so forth. So it was really fun, but I made very few friends by writing that. And one of the reasons why I am in Washington is that Mr. López Obrador was not my friend, and he won the election to be mayor of my city. So I sold all my properties and packed, and I'm here. So that explains why I was alluded to by Jonathan, something I'm very grateful for.
So, Manuel, you have filled out your citizenship forms and are just waiting for July 3rd to submit them?
I now have a green card that I can show you, and I'm legal. Sydney, I'm legal now here, and interestingly enough, the green card is not green. It's only white.
Manuel, we're glad that you're not among the 500, 1,000. But let's go around.
Hi, Alejandro Sturman with IPD Latin America. Well, I would like to ask the panelists if they can tell us a little bit about the significance of the Chapultepec Accords. I think the real name is Acuerdo Nacional para la Unidad, el Estado de Derecho, el Estado, el Desarrollo, Inversión y el Empleo. Even that these accords were launched, I think, or orchestrated by Carlos Slim. So I would like to know what are the real consequences And second, it seems to me that López Obrador, while not unfriendly with the markets, it has been slow to address some of the problems of the Mexican economy. So I would like to hear from the panelists what approach could he take in the future to get closer to the Mexican business elites.
I think that the best person to answer that would probably be Mario in terms of the Chapultepec Accords, but I'd just like to, before he says anything, my own opinion, I think that they're irrelevant. Just that's my summary, my executive summary. But but I'll let Mario.
I could say that they also, I can say that they're irrelevant, and the main reason is that they don't involve any compromise for no one. No one compromises anything, and that's really the problem. It was good for the pictures and for the front pages in the newspapers, but more than that, nothing, nothing. And regarding your question about López Obrador, one thing I like to mention is that so far we have seen three López Obrador. One is the one publishing this book, The 50 Points for the Progress and Growth of the Mexican Economy, which these 50 points are equivalent to the Chapultepec Agreement. It's nothing. It's are totally irrelevant. But that's one López Obrador. The other López Obrador that we have seen so far is the one who appeared in the Financial Times interview. Probably you read that interview. He was very friendly to the markets, and he was oriented to private investment and things like that. And a lot of people liked that interview, but we still have another one, which is the one appearing in front of Congress, in front of Congress when he was being charged by abusing the law and going against the law. And how this López Obrador was looked? Well, first of all, he was against the law. He was very aggressive, and also marching in the streets like the Chavez style, marching in the streets and saying, "So I'm so popular that I really challenge you to apply me the law, and you're going to face the society." So we have three López Obrador seen so far. I won't say which one is going to rule.
Yeah, but sorry, if I can just going a little bit more specific. I mean, I don't see any contradictions of López Obrador being still very popular and trying to appease the market or talking to the press outside Mexico or to the financial press, telling a little bit of you know what kind of economic policy he will follow, and try to make a connection with the markets. And this is what I think is missing, and I don't really understand the reason why. Why he's following this approach.
Yeah, if you, well, may I? Okay, I would say that at least from the point of view of the things that he has written and the things that he has been saying in his public appearances, one thing is clear, he's not going to raise taxes, he's not going to design new taxes, and he says that he's going to save a lot of money from public expenditure, and that money is going to be used in his public programs, welfare programs. And in those terms, what we are really afraid is that how is going to the growth is going to be impulsed in this situation. Well, one of the things that we are really afraid of is that he has indeed one way to go out of this situation. One is public debt. He has a really international market open for Mexico and really willing to lend us more money, which he can use it. And he proved in Mexico City that he can raise the public debt a lot using his the public budget to finance his social programs and issuing debt in order to make some infrastructure. And the other thing that is open to him is to issue internal debt, not only external debt, but internal debt. And the other, he has been announcing this for quite a long time, that he's going to stop paying the IPAP or FOA PROA debt, which is really quite a bit of money there. And well, those three ways involve a high risk, very high risk.
I would, yeah, I was exactly where I was headed. I think that's kind of where the risk is. I think that it, Mario says that there's three López Obradors. I think that there's more like maybe 10. I mean, and the problem is that he's all over the map. And I think that the biggest risk is that we have no idea what López Obrador would really be. He could be actually, he has the potential of actually being a good president. He could actually shift towards the center, take his popularity, use it right, do actually intelligent things. The guy is intelligent. He has the potential of being actually a good president. But the problem is that he could also be one of the worst presidents we've ever had. And that's what scares everybody, is that we have absolutely no idea. He came out with not only his 50-point plan, before that he came out with a 20-point plan. And you sit down and you kind of read everything, and there's two or three points that kind of almost scare you, depending on how you want to interpret it. But then a lot of the things that he has are just, you know, kind of really doing almost really what Fox was doing. For example, he says that he's going to use construction as a pillar to push the economy. But that's basically what Fox has been doing. I mean, the number of housing that Fox has done is breaking records, and Fox has really been doing that. And a lot of the things that he said isn't really necessarily really new ideas. But there are two or three things there that really scare everybody. One is the EPUB issue. I mean, if he really truly tries to do that, I mean, he could really, really mess up a lot of things. And that is very scary. And then the other part, I think, which is even probably more essential, which we're all kind of afraid of López Obrador, and he's proven to do this in various occasions, is that when he wants to do something and either Congress doesn't let him or the judicial system doesn't let him or whatever it is, he somehow or other disregards it. And then it's kind of this disregard for the law issue, I think, that at the end of the day is probably the one part that we're more afraid of than anything else. He would probably come and say, okay, we're not going to pay EPUB, and then the judicial branch will say, I'm sorry, you know, that you can't say you can't, and then he'll try and block payment anyway. And that could really potentially really damage institutions in Mexico, and I think that is the one underlying thing that everybody is really, really scared about. All the other points of maybe out of the 50, 40-some points, or maybe 45 points, or really nothing. I mean, it's just demagogue. It's just you know, blank promises. But it's just those two or three, I think, pending things that we're really scared of.
Sergio, but before you, yeah. Can I ask you, besides the comment that you're going to make, is it possible to flesh the EPUB out in terms of, let's say, playing out that scenario? Jonathan said that it would have a tremendous, you know, it would be a disaster, let's say. Can we play that out a little bit? What would be directly some of the repercussions should that actually be a decision that he takes?
Yeah. Well, first, I totally agree. I think that the Chapultepec Accords are basically none in the sense of a real commitment, but I think that they are important in terms of the message they send from a political point of view. And I think that in that respect, López Obrador is positioning himself product differentiation in the sense that he's the only one of the leading candidates who is not signing these pacts. And in the last few weeks, in each and every of conventions, the stock market convention, the different fora, at which the candidates have been attending, the only one who hasn't been attending has been López Obrador. So I think that to some extent that plays a little bit towards this positioning himself as a different candidate. The thing that makes the news about the stock market convention, I don't know if he actually went to the American Chamber convention this week, but it is not who's signing, but actually who's not signing. And in that respect, there's a product differentiation, which I think makes a lot of sense from the point of view of political campaigning for Mr. López Obrador. And I think that in that respect, it also goes with his instincts, which is very much what Mary and Jonathan were talking about, that deep inside, I think that there are some issues that from the point of view of López Obrador conviction are points that are not negotiable. I think that he sees this thing of reaching agreement with different business groups as something that will happen once he's in the presidency, not before. He has these hints in the different documents. Actually, the document Professor Weintraub was talking about, the Televisa interviews, is very interesting in the sense that he makes these very rational points, probably a lot of spending in construction, etc. But nevertheless, here and there, there are hints of deep-seated conviction that what we need to do are changes in the system, and that, for example, the way to pay for increased investment in Pemex for this construction program has to do with savings and with fighting corruption. And for him, that has to do with the IPAP-FOBAPROA issue. Basically, actually, when the suggestion, the part which is probably the most controversial one is that he is talking about creating this truth commission about the FOBAPROA, which is a part in which it would be difficult. I mean, when we look at the legal procedures, certainly the process is over. The process is already settled, but probably the contentious or the issue to be concerned about is that he talks about this Comisión de la Verdad, this Strat Commission, and it's not clear what a Strat Commission can find, in the sense that that if it is going to be something that is going to work according to a determined structure with a established institution and rules of operation, or it is basically a witch hunt in which we have some political aims. So basically, that's the situation. I think that for him it is an issue in which he's going to be insisting throughout the campaign. It's an issue that has a lot of political impact for him. It's one of the things he's going to be stressing throughout the whole process of the elections. And that when we look at the way in which problem is structured, there's no way of going back into the current arrangement, unless you decide to go into an extra legal situation. And that's probably what Jonathan had in mind when you were talking about this scary part of AMLO personality.
The extreme that some people think, and I think this has an extremely low possibility, but just kind of the extreme scenario, is defaulting on the EPA bonds. And I think that by the time, I'm not too sure about this, but by the time new president comes in, there won't be any more FOBAPROA debt. It'll be all changed over into IPA bonds, which means that it's the equivalent of CETES or BONDES or anything else. It's going to be a completely, fully recognized federal government debt. And if López Obrador wants to default on that, that is what I mean by the really extreme, scary scenario. I don't think we'll ever get there, but that's kind of the one extreme that some people have mentioned that López Obrador might be capable of doing. If it's just a truth commission, kind of a witch hunt, we've seen those in the past, and they really never get anywhere, and I wouldn't be too worried about that.
Okay. I've got Norman, and then William, and then Tom, and Alejandro. I'll add you to the list.
Thank you very much, Norman Bailey, Potomac Foundation. A most interesting discussion. The first speaker made a point which was both startling and unobvious, and then he passed on to everything else without commenting on it. And that is that despite the fact that in the very recent past, everybody was worried that the maquila section was sector of the economy was going to disappear because of Asian and particularly Chinese competition, it apparently is growing at the highest rate of any sector of the Mexican economy. And I don't know if you would like to comment on the reasons for that or anybody and any of the other panelists.
Well, I believe that the reason for this recent expansion of maquiladora industry is that we finally have found our comparative advantages in the electronic industry. Also, electronic industry, some electrical components and auto parts. Mostly in those sectors.
I'd like to just add one little comment to that. I think that yes, the maquila is definitely bouncing back, but there's extreme amount of structural change within the maquila. A lot of industries disappeared and never came back, like textiles and things like that, and you're seeing others that are surging. But the most important thing about that is that even though maquila is growing at a relatively good pace, it's not creating the jobs that it created before. And even though you do see some job creation, if you look at the total production versus job creation, like the implicit productivity, but basically maquila is growing more on productivity because of the structural changes, and it's not creating the jobs that it had before. Maquila production, I don't know exactly, but I would intuitively think it's probably back and maybe above the peak that it achieved in 2000 in terms of production, but in terms of the number of jobs created in the maquila sector, it's still way below the peak of 2000. And maquila was the promise of job creation more than anything else. So if it's growing but it's not creating the jobs, well then the whole idea of the maquila sector is questionable.
If I could just follow up, Armand, if auto parts are an important aspect of that growth, well, the fact that the two largest auto producers in the United States are basically bankrupt going to have any effect on that?
Well, I would say that will help the Mexican industry to really become a reliable supplier of parts for the American market. Most of the automobile production are moving out of the United States, and most of it is going to China, India, and Russia, and places like that. But reasonably large enough an amount of this production is going to Mexico, and I hope that it's only a hope, that these firms are going to really take advantage of this situation and become reliable suppliers. That's I think that's the biggest challenge, to become a reliable supplier.
Yeah, well, the case of the motor vehicle and auto part industry is interesting in the sense that implicitly in Mexico we assume that the consequence of restructuring of American firms were going to have a higher share of North American production. But we like to keep silent on that because we know that there is an important discussion that needs to be done with the unions in the States, for example, and in Canada about these issues, which is, for example, something that I would say is part of an agenda for North American discussion, for regional integration, and that's something that we have been evading in Mexico so far. Another thing which I think is related to the recent recovery of Maquiladora is that, to some extent, I feel that firms, extra-regional firms, prefer that form of business model in Mexico, particularly those firms coming from Asia, in order to integrate operations in North America. So that's probably another reason why we have seen a revival of Maquiladora. Productivity, consolidation, larger plants, there are some gains in economies of scale. But we also saw that some companies actually moved from the traditional manufacturing regime into the maquiladora regime. And I'm not sure to what extent INEGI, the Statistical Institute, captured that. So probably that is also having an impact on the rate of growth of the manufacturing traditional segment and the maquiladora as well, in this year at least. But it seems that extra-regional producers are favoring the maquiladora model over the traditional manufacturing one.
William. I'm Bill Price, a former professional diplomat. I'd like to ask a question about institutions in Mexico, particularly the one mentioned aside the banking system, which was the Electoral Commission. And I think, you know, Armand, you and I were at the 2000 elections, which were outstanding in terms of what they accomplished for Mexico. But as I remember it, they required a huge investment. And the figure was $1 billion in terms of money with first-class people and highly respected, and also political investment of President Zedillo, who put his full powers behind having a honest, respected election, which was, you know, highly successful worldwide in comparison to other elections. And I just wonder if that investment continues to be made, and I would guess that President Fox doesn't have the political capital that President Zedillo had, but if he's going to use whatever he has, and if the money is going to be forthcoming to make those elections honest and fair. I remember Zedillo saying, you know, my election was I want to have elections that are free and fair. My election was free. Fox is the first one that had a fair election. Will that happen again? Will the money be put in there? And is the political climate such that you won't have 70 years of tradition, but you'll have the new tradition?
I'll make the first comment. I think that the problem actually is now kind of gone almost the other way. I think we're spending too much money. And the problem now is that everybody's worried that there's just too much money and it's just not justified. The amount of money that each political party is receiving this year, because of the way the law was constructed, increases every year, and it just keeps on going up and up and up. And we're spending a ridiculous amount of money now. And I think that everybody, society, everybody, I think, is really pressuring the government and Congress to have a new electoral reform to reduce the amount of money spent, because it was justified back then, but it doesn't really seem to be justified that much today. Second of all, in terms, I think, of credibility, I think Wardenberg did a very excellent job. And I think that the transition from him to Ugalde kind of reduced a little bit of that credibility. And not because Ugalde is doing a bad job, but it's just that I think that the way the IFE's kind of board of governors or whatever it's called is constructed is when everybody who had experience is eliminated and then you have a complete new board. That's, I think, too radical, too drastic of a way. I think that the way the Bank of Mexico deals it with the scaled persons into the board is much better, because you have a combination maybe of a new person with the experience, and you don't wipe out all your previous experience. The problem with the IFE is that wasn't that easy, because all the different members of the board are kind of, it's a political negotiation. So how do you kind of do that on a one-by-one basis? It's easier to do it on a group basis. But I think that the Ugalde IFE has, I wouldn't say lost credibility, but it still has to prove itself. And I think by what Sergio was saying, by not showing, you know, the yellow and the red cards and time and everything, they've taken some pretty big blows in terms of their credibility. So I think that the IFE is coming into these elections with less, I think, credibility than it had before, and with the image from everywhere that it has just too much money, and that the problem is how can we take away money from the IFE instead of giving them more.
Yes. I would like to add that on the comment made by Jonathan, that also in the construction of the actual Board of Representatives in the IFE, PRD has not a representation, and that it's going to be a problem, a big issue in the future, especially because, as Sergio mentioned before, we expect a very tight competition in the electoral year next year. We don't expect someone to win for more than 5 percentage points. And in that aspect, it's going to be very important that PRD has not a representation in this board in the IFE. And I don't know if I can talk a little bit about another important institution, which is Congress in Mexico. And Sergio was mentioning this technical tie that the recent polls show. But I would say that behind this technical tie, we have close to taking a look at the recent elections in the last couple of years in Mexico, we can see a 45% of people don't showing up in the elections, which is a really large percentage of abstentionism. And regarding the 55% who is really showing up, 30% of those doesn't know for which party are they going to vote. So everything is open. What has to do this with the Congress? Well, we can build up at least three scenarios. One of these is PRI, pre-voting together with PAN, which is very, well, likely, because they share the same economic project, and PRD as usual being voting against. The other scenario is PAN voting with probably with PRI, because so far we have seen a PAN very unable to reach agreements with any of these parties, because probably they are not willing to pay the prices that has to be paid in Congress for the negotiations. And so it's probably this scenario is going to be a little an extension of what we have been seeing in the last 5 years in Mexico. And the last scenario is PRD voting probably with PRI, with PRI. And PAN not voting with them. And what this implies? Well, probably PRD is not willing to pay the price that that the PRI will ask for their vote. So only in one scenario, only if PRI is the ruling majority and also he can get the vote of the together with the PAN, probably this is the best scenario in favor of the reforms and in favor of same common project, economic project, because the other two, I would say, in the other PAN PRI is going to be an extension of what we are seeing now, and PRD PRI is probably is going to be the worst scenario.
Just a very quick comment. I totally agree with you. I mean, we have a problem because the Zedillo factor of the president going on national television in order to acknowledge victory of the candidate of the opposition is an important element that is not going to be present in this election, and that role is going to be taken by the electoral tribunal, which is different from the electoral institute. In the case of the electoral institute, we have major contradiction, which is the fact that the role of the federal institute is to guarantee that parties behave properly, but nevertheless, its budget is approved by parties in Congress. So as the federal institute has been imposing fines on each and every one of the major parties, there is no incentive for the parties to go and offer a defense of that electoral institute. So the electoral institute is sort of isolated into that respect. There's the issue of a lot of money being spent. In some cases, it is actually imposed by decisions of Congress. We were just talking about these votes from Mexicans living abroad, from migrants, and Manuel was telling me about some figures. It's going to be really expensive, basically, and that was against the institute's decision of going into something which wasn't practical at all. And it is creating a lot of criticism about the amount of money that is going to be spent there. So actually, yeah, the problem is that beyond the institutional actors, the electoral institute and the electoral tribunal, we don't have this sort of symbolic actors such as Mexican president or any other power factor that is going to be there in order to guarantee that the elections are not only democratic but also fair. And that's an important difference vis-a-vis what we had in 2000. So yeah, there's a risk there, and I think it's an important risk.
Let me just make one quick point. In fact, the politicized composition of the IFE to some extent is a backlash to the point that Sergio was making about the political parties pushing back because the previous IFE to some extent had encroached on their interests. And so to some extent, what you see is a pushback on the part of the parties creating a politicized composition to the IFE. And the budget point is an interesting one, Sergio. Tom.
Thank you. I'm Tom Reckford with the World Affairs Council. Actually, Norm Bailey stole the question I was going to ask about the maquiladoras, because I too thought that China was eating Mexico's lunch and attracting that kind of investment. But let me add on the question, does López Obrador have a policy on the maquiladoras? Is he for them? Is he against them? Does he have other notions about how to attract new investment to Mexico?
Well, I don't think he has really a notion or an idea of how to attract investments into Mexico. He proposes in his book that the only way for the government to go out with the construction infrastructure and public projects is to get together in association with the private sector. But he really doesn't. He hasn't mentioned how he's going. How this is going to be done. As far as industrial policy is related in these proposals of López Obrador. The only thing he's proposing is something like what happened in Mexico in the area in the era of Cárdenas, Lázaro Cárdenas, in 1934, and we live again in the epoca in the era of López Portillo in 1982 when he said let's take oil as the impulse for the industrialization of Mexico, which well I believe this experience has proven that it's not really successful. And but that's as far as I have read, this is his whole proposal. He doesn't have a plan for the maquiladora. He believes a lot of in construction, but we believe that's the worst alternative.
Thanks, Armand. I'm Alejandro González Durán, recently graduated from the MPA at Columbia University. I'd like to add or shed light into another important date on the political calendar, December 15. That is the due date for registering presidential alliances at IFE. The outcome is relevant in three different aspects, I think. One is that after that day, we will know how many presidential candidates we're going to have besides the three main parties, if what is the Green Party going to do, what is Convergencia going to do, and what is the PT going to do. Secondly, it's important because once parties sign up their presidential coalitions, they have to be together with those parties qualified into all the federal positions. That means the 500 seats on the chamber and the 128 senators. Sorry. And thirdly, because I think that issue also allows us to see how preferences are going to be aligned in terms of this sum or of parties' preferences. Secondly, in terms of what kind of race we're going to face on July. It is true that the literature establishes that within a first-past-the-post system or a majority system, preferences tend to align along the two front runners. However, I'm not sure if that will change in case the PRI is running on the third place due to the significant share of the rural vote that this party has still. Like in the country, I would like to ask the panelists if they agree or disagree on this respect. And my last point would be going back to the what is the perception of the institutional framework we have in Mexico. Jonathan Heath and Mario Rodarte agreed that we are increasing our solid institutions in Mexico. However, Sergio, you said that especially the IFE and the Electoral Tribunal could be something to consider in the outcome of the election. I think that if Mexico is able to have like an easy election, that would be a proof of the Mexico's not just transition to democracy, but the consolidation of our democracy. I don't know if you guys want to comment on that. Thank you.
I'll start, I guess, if that's okay. No, I think, well, first of all, I think in terms of coalitions, I think the only really relevant one, the only important one is with the Green Boys Party. I think that right now the Green Party has about 7%, if I remember right, in polls, roughly around there, which is very good for them because in the past I think they've really been about 4 to 5. And this guy, Bernardo, is a relatively kind of popular. He seems to be kind of having a favorable vote, et cetera. And I think that everybody is wanting to negotiate. The Green Party has kind of not really stated who they're in favor of. And the Green Party is capable of negotiating with anybody because they have no really true ideology except their family fortune, and it's just that their family interests really more than anything else, not even the party's interests. But I think that's the only really relevant one. And right now, from what I've read up, it's not very sure. And the Green Party themselves are kind of divided. Bernardo himself wants to be the candidate. But the other parties kind of realize that that 7% vote, even if it only ends up being 5 or 6% vote, could actually make the difference between winning and losing. So they are negotiating, and the Green Party is selling itself very expensively in terms of it wants to guarantee a certain number of seats and this and that and the other, and they're really, really selling themselves expensively. But I think that's going to be key, I agree, but it's the only one. The other ones, I think, are irrelevant unless Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas suddenly appears somewhere and decides to be a candidate with one of these parties. That kind of the issue comes and goes. Everybody, I don't think he will be, but if he does, he could be a spoiler for López Obrador. And then also I think that you're right in terms of the way the voting configuration is done for the second place seats in the Senate and the plurinominales, etc. The PRI will actually come out favored in that. Because if you remember, in every single governor election in all 32 entities, and I think there's no exception to that, maybe Sergio can tell me if there is, I don't think there is the PRI has always, and he's either first or second, never third. And the interesting part is that on the national level, some of the polls are now suggesting that the PRI is actually in third place. So it's interesting to see the PRI in third place at a national election, but on a state level, it's never been in third. And I think that even though if the PRI ends up being third in the presidential elections, it will probably still gather a proportional number of those seats that are assigned on that basis in Congress. So it'll probably be have a bigger representation than just a third place. And that's what I would think. Mario.
Okay, let me just clarify a couple of points. One is, I think it's between December 1st and December 10th, which is the window to register your coalitions. I don't know if it's December 15th, but there's a window starting December 1st on the 10th. It's December 1st to December 10th. You're right, coalitions, there are no partial coalitions. The coalitions would have to be agreed upon, and it would incorporate the Congress. It is important in terms of finding out basically what the race will look like. On Heath's point on first place and second place finishes, it only affects the Senate. There are 64 64 seats out of the 128, 64 are directly elected. 32 go to the second place. And then the remaining go to proportional representation. But it's a formula that only impacts the Senate, not the Chamber of Deputies.
I agree with Jonathan, but I think the recent polls show that things are accommodating in Mexico. And this comfortable majority that López Obrador was having in the near past now, he's looking at it as vanishing, and he's making him very nervous, this situation as he's going. I don't see a PRI going in second place or third place, because taking a look at the recent electoral processes in Mexico in the last couple of years, we see the PRI winning 10 out of 12 state elections. It's true, they have a very low percentage of voters, but still they won. They have the largest proportion of local deputies in local congresses, and they still have the finest working electoral machinery. And that's one thing that, if we contrast this with the PAN hasn't won anything in the near past. They are still finding a lot of difficulties getting together and getting things, showing things coherent for the public. And PRD, they are really showing just the strong hand of López Obrador, but at the interior of the PRD, probably you know that the PRD is composed by tribes. We call them the leftist tribes, and we haven't seen how the final arrangements among the tribes is going to show up, because we are going to see them after the election of the local candidate for the for the capital in Mexico, and that's really a strong war between these tribes. And I don't see really a pre in third place, and I'm not. This doesn't allow me to say that pre is going to win the election, but I don't see him as a third place at all.
Thank you. And on the coalitions, I think that's an important point. And I think that it illustrates that López Obrador campaigns goes far beyond the PRD. He cannot win with the PRD. He needs to strike coalitions. And that's the explanation for the coalition with the PT, which was a very high price that they paid at the expense of the representation of PRD members in Congress in 2000, in the Congress for in the next Congress. Manuel was telling me that he just struck a deal with Convergencia, and now it is PRD plus Convergencia plus PT. That illustrates very much that in this case, López Obrador is clear that he cannot win the presidency only on the back of the PRD. He needs to strike coalitions. That is increasing the prices of those coalitions. Verde, the Green Party, is certainly advertising very well on those 7 points that they got in a survey, and they are going to they're going to sell that coalition very high. So the issue now is coalitions. And another important thing in terms of the regional composition, which goes back to a point that Armand was just mentioning a few minutes ago about what is going to be the composition for Congress for the party which has the largest regional representation, which is the PRI. That's certainly, I agree with Mario. In terms of electoral machinery, that's the party which has the best electoral machinery. It is competing in two different competitions, so to speak. In the north, it is competing with the PAN, and in the south, it is competing with the PRD. So it has to make a competition in two different fronts. And in that respect, I think that the ideal strategy for Mr. Madrazo in order to have a very efficient electoral machinery is to distribute power with, for example, governors. That would help to reduce some of the bruises from the competition for the candidacy. This Operación Cicatriz is trying to close the wounds created by very strong internal struggle. But that will mean that PRI candidates to the Congress will not respond to Mr. Madrazo, but will respond to regional leaders. Of course, if he wins the presidency, we're back to the old system in which the president is the only authority figure from the point of view of Mr. Madrazo. But if he loses the elections, that means that we're going to have a PRI that is going to have an important representation in Congress, but is not going to be following any single leadership. So that's important.
And that's, I think, probably, I don't want to say the worst scenario, but it's not a good scenario, because you end up having pretty much the pre that we've had during this administration, where they're so divided that unfortunately it's very difficult to actually build any consensus within that party. I'd like to end early. We have two questions left, and Manuel, and then the gentleman in the back.
Yeah, I want to add some black clouds as Sydney sort of threw into this, because everyone is very happy about the strength of institutions, and the point was just made by Armand. Congress, in the alternative that the PAN wins, number one, number two. That the other two losers are willing to concede, which is not clear. They are going to claim that they won and there was fraud. Number three, we have a very weak executive that has repeatedly yielded to blackmail. Mr. Fox has not been threatened by any blackmail he has not yielded to up to now, okay? There's a consistent behavior there. But let's assume that the PAN candidate wins and gets to power. At that moment, the PRD candidate wins and gets to power. López Obrador becomes the next president. By which means, by the way, he's going to announce someone very good and that all the markets and all the institutions like ours will applaud to be his finance minister. They've been sounding people, including in this town, that we all know the names. So he's going to run in the middle of the road type of thing and try to assuage all the markets and everyone. But let's see what he gets there. At that moment, the true López Obrador will start to appear. And his first move is going to try to gather all the disenfranchised PRI congressmen. Because the only thing that kept them together, the PRI doesn't have an ideology. I mean, look at it. It has been 80 years around, and it has gone from extreme socialism to liberal policies and everything in between. So they only have interests. And what held the PRI together after the 2000 was the hope of coming back. If they don't come back this time, that's it. That's the end of the road. So there's going to be López Obrador with a checkbook attracting them. And he's going to forge a new majority in Congress. Once he does that, the Venezuelan route is very easy. And the Venezuelan route, let's remember that Venezuela had very strong institutions as well, much better electoral institutions for many years than Mexico did. And all of those are gone, including the central bank that Mr. Chavez just reinvented in another fashion, an alternative central bank. All of that can happen easily in Mexico if the scenario of AMLO getting there occurs.
In the back. That's a very good question. I don't know who wants to tackle it. I'll have a comment, but after you all have taken a shot at it.
One of the main criticisms that President Fox has attracted is regarded with his ability to not only to propose an option, but also what's plan B. And I believe that in terms of the strategy for the energy reform, Plan A, we can already rule it out. I mean, the huge reforms, I don't see any probability to see them in the future. As you say, Sydney, no candidate has really mentioned this point, and I don't think they are going to put it in the campaign because that means probably some loss of votes, a large number of votes. What's Plan B? Plan B is being worked by the government. One, in terms of the reforms proposed for the corporate government in Pemex, because, you know, this Sarbanes-Oxley regulation, the new regulation here in the market, Pemex has some issues of debt here. So Pemex has to accomplish this Sarbanes-Oxley regulation. So Secretary de Hacienda proposed an adjustment in the corporate government. This was proposed for this budget, for the budget discussed last month in the Senate and also in the Chamber of Deputies in Mexico, but it was saved apart by the syndicate, by the union of workers in Pemex. So, but it has to be discussed in the future. And the only thing that it's probably ready to be discussed in Congress has to do with this new law of budget in Mexico. What is this law of budget contains? Well, first of all, is the one disposition that the government can spend everything he can raise, not more. I mean, deficit is ruled out in this new law of budget. The other thing has to do with the income of Pemex, and also has to do with how this income is going to be spent, and the possibility that Pemex goes to the domestic debt market, which is, as you know, there is a large amount of funds in our financial system that so far have been used only by the federal government, but there is still a huge opportunity there. So I believe Plan B has to do with the small and but very significant changes that has to be done for the corporate government and also in the budget, in the new law for the budget.
Yeah, no, the main points I agree with. I want to talk a little bit about Plan A a little bit, as well as Plan B. I don't think it'll come up in the campaign too much, except in generalities. But I don't think whoever becomes president, I think doesn't have too much time after that. So I expect it to become an issue during the course of 2006, after there's a new president, 2007, after there's a new president that has to face the issues facing the country. I don't know what partial privatization fully of Pemex means. The models that exist around the hemisphere, and the people in Mexico have looked at them very carefully, particularly Petrobras in Brazil and the Canadian issue. Petrobras, in a way, is more relevant only because Mexico considers itself a competitor of Brazil. And since Petrobras has now got a much higher reputation, even though it's a smaller company than Pemex, what they're doing matters. And Petrobras is a wholly owned government operation. And nobody in Brazil talks about privatizing it. What they do is permit private investment alongside of that. And in every single one of these investments so far, Petrobras is a majority shareholder. In other words, you do get private investment without ever privatizing the institute itself. And I think that when U.S. sources, including the oil companies, talk about privatizing Pemex, they're going about it completely the wrong way. They ought to talk about trying to follow a model similar to what Canada does, for example. The oil company in Canada has a publicly owned company, but they also accept a lot of private investment along that. I think that's what Plan A, I think, has to be if there is a Plan A. But even that Plan A takes a constitutional amendment and other changes, so it's not easy to do. Plan B, there are all kinds of Plan Bs, but I don't think you can perpetually borrow. I don't think you can perpetually take away all of the money that Pemex earns, take away, put them in a loss position, and then make them debtors, borrowing all the time. And as some of you said, Pedrigas or something, it's pretty borrowed out right now. I mean, you're right, as a transition technique, it was really quite clever. But transitions run their course. So I don't know what Plan B is either.
I will just add, I totally agree, and I think that the major problem for having any reform, which I believe that the Petrobras model would be ideal for the Mexican circumstances, is that I don't see how to push with changes in Pemex unless it is not seen as part of an overall strategy, of a big idea about what we want to do in terms of energy markets, for example. I don't see any of the candidates talking, for example, about the complementarities that can be obtained by integration of North American energy markets, which is an important issue in the U.S. and Canada. In Mexico, it's out of the discussion. It's still an issue that is isolated. All that has to do with Pemex and with energy is an issue that is discussed in isolation. And in that sense, we see it is important for the Madrazo and López Obrador platforms, economic platforms, in the sense that they seem to imply that they will stress a lot the oil industry, but it's not clear why they pretend to do with the oil industry. So in that sense, I think that unless we have major vision, a strategic vision of what we want to do with energy, we're going to go into this incremental phase of reforms in which we're going to probably be facing issues such as PDRegas, just little by little, and that's precisely what we don't need any longer or what is not working any longer for the oil industry in Mexico.
I'm just going to make one quick comment on that. I mean, when you look at the energy experts and their projections in terms of the amount of money that the energy sector needs in order to modernize its infrastructure, Plan B really is not much of an option. Plan B is an option just in terms of political viability, but it's not an option in real terms in terms of attracting the type of investment that the sector needs. Plan A, unfortunately, doesn't provide the legal security to prospective investors to invest in Mexico. So Mexico's caught in a catch-22. I think the question of, you know, has Mexico missed an opportunity given the high price of oil? I think there's no question it has missed it. Not from my point of view, not just in terms of energy reform, but more so from the standpoint of pushing through fiscal reform. And I'll tell you why. In my opinion, there's an incredible amount of skepticism on the part of the Mexican people over whether their money is actually put to use. Why pay taxes if the money's going to be squandered? If I were a politician in Mexico, I would have tried to take advantage of the high price of oil, because when you do push through fiscal reform, if you want it to stick and to be a successful model that changes the culture of tax payment in Mexico, whoever's in government and in Congress will have to push through major, major programs to show the Mexican people that paying taxes does render a benefit. Otherwise, tax reform, I think, could be short-lived. The benefits of tax reform in Mexico could be short-lived, and you end up going back to a lot of tax evasion. So I think it's a missed opportunity on two fronts, fiscal reform and energy reform.
I would add that on a third front, which was just taking advantage of the non-recurring revenues. I mean, I think that what we did was just throw it away and give it to the participating to the states and local governments and squandered on who knows what stupid investment projects, local investment projects, if it was even invested, instead of reducing debt or doing whatever you should do when you have a non-recurring revenue. So I think it was lost on three fronts.
Let me make one other point, then turn it over to Bill. Mine will be one sentence. I think you were pointing out, Mario, that what López Obrador said, he's going to raise the money that he needs to eliminate any waste and fraud in the government. I've heard U.S. politicians use that line now for as long as I've been alive, and it almost always, I don't know of any single exception, there may be some, it's a cop-out. It really says, I'm not going to do anything, and if I need the money, I'll go out and borrow it.
Actually, what that means, in real terms, it would mean going against the union movement in Mexico, because one of the large expenses in the public sector is obviously as a result of the large size of the bureaucracy. So I don't think it's even doable on that front. William.
I'd like just to go back very quickly to what Sydney brought up is immigration. We didn't really have much of a discussion on it. I think, one, there's not a real problem in economically absorbing 500,000 people in the United States because they don't come up here and not get jobs. But
somebody else gets less money.
Well, true. But I wonder if it's how much of a problem it is for Mexico in terms of Mexico's economic problems. I mean, they're losing people. Some of their better people, which happens in every immigration situation. But is it a problem, aside from the fact that the conditions are so bad that that's why they go, but is it an economic problem in Mexico?
I'd say it's actually the other way around. Mexican families are now sending back, in terms of remittances, this year it could reach maybe $20 billion. And that's... if it wasn't for high oil prices, it would be way above our normal year-to-year amount of oil exports. And actually, it's been a kind of a stabilizer in a lot of different regions and has helped out a lot of different lower-income families. And actually, it's been a very big benefit for Mexico. Otherwise, those people would not have had jobs in Mexico, and that amount of revenue sent back to Mexico would not be there.
Probably you remember in the near past in the United States this television ad for this gastritis remedium. They say, how do you spell relief? In Mexico, the authorities say M-I-G-R-A-T-I-O-N. It's a relief for our economy. Otherwise, it's going to be a lot of social pressure. Really, really amazing pressure.
I will just add that we are always under the assumption that, there's a loss of human capital. Nevertheless, they are sending dollars, and that helps the balance of payments. But that's under the assumption that they will keep sending dollars, and that will be different from migrations to the U.S. in the past, in which migrants are usually assimilated, and eventually they start to lose the contacts with their communities in their places of origin. So we are working in Mexico under the assumption that they will keep being Mexican and send money someone else back home, which is, I think, that so far the studies I know seem to conclude that that's the case. But that will be different from previous episodes of migration. So that's one point. Now let's assume that they eventually will go back. I mean, that the reason why they're sending money is because eventually they will think about retiring in Mexico. That means that that money that they are sending now, if it is used for consumption only, will eventually imply that when they go back to Mexico to retire and they are older, there won't be any capital in order to provide for retirement for those people. And I think that illustrates that for the moment being, we are just focusing on the fact that in the short term, they are providing additional revenue, that we are not looking at the whole issue of migration from the point of view of, again, integration into a North American region.
Do I finally get here? David King, National Defense University. I want to go back to what Mario opened with and what Sydney stressed, the competitiveness, the informality in the economy, the migration issues. Going forward, we've talked a lot about López Obrador. We haven't talked much about, other than the very scary scenario that Manuel raised, where we go with Calderón and Madrazo 6 years in the next sexenio on these competitiveness issues. Do we see some business licensing reform? Do we see some labor market reform? Or does Mexico continue to export 1% of its labor force annually? And just think what happens if the housing boom, construction boom dries up here, and American unemployment goes from the Naira at 5% to 7%, and that 2% increase falls almost wholly on the undocumented migrant population. What if this country passes, which it might, leading up to an election, a very tough border control? What does that do to the Mexican election? I mean, this is more political science discussion than it is an economic discussion, but the two are so closely tied we can't escape. Your comments, please, gentlemen.
Well, I believe you are totally right in your point. And so far, we haven't been able to tackle the problem on an integral way. And what I mean by an integral way is to combine education, combine the labor market, and also to allow private investment in several strategic sectors. Because so far, and this brings back my comment to the what I was saying about the sustainability of the 3% inflation, if you remember the books 20 years ago in monetary theory, you remember this theory of cost push and demand pull inflation. Yeah. And I really didn't believe in this cost push inflation, because the only thing I saw in Mexico, at least for the last 30 years, was demand pull inflation. But now, when the core inflation is 3.12% in Mexico, and we see that most of the markets, the input markets, are inflexible, like the labor market, the energy market, the land market, and we have very high transaction costs. Going by overregulation, corruption, the absence of the rule of law, and also a very severe security issue, and the the expectation is that these costs are going up in the future, not going down. This brings back the ideas, yeah, what are we going to do for to solve this problem of migration? And I don't see a short term or a solution in the short term, because as I mentioned before, we have to do it through education, because yes, most of our children have access to the educational system, but most of them are flunked in the comprehension of lecture. And also, we have a labor market, we're generating jobs, but more than 60% are informal. And what's the limit of that? And also, we have to allow private investment, because the government hasn't enough resources to invest in the strategic areas. And not only strategic areas, most of the areas of the government, we have, in Mexico, we can test this saying by Milton Friedman, that if the government were allowed to manage the Sahara Desert, it would be a scarcity of sand. So in Mexico, it happens the same. Whatever the government takes control of is always a mess. And so we have to allow private investment, because you say something very important, Sydney, this model of Petrobras. We don't have anything, I personally don't have anything against the government-owned enterprise, especially for oil. What happens is that the board of trustees in Pemex, I believe it's composed by 11 members. Yeah, 11 members. Five of them are from the union. This is really amazing. And what have we seen in the past 67 years? Well, the union controls several construction firms that the contracts has to be given by Pemex to the union in order to build some plants and also to the reparations necessary for things going. Also, the union controls the distribution of oil and gas and several things. They're amazing. It's a lot of money really flowing out of the enterprise and going out of our pockets, because whoever we are held by the government, we have to pay taxes no matter what happens in the Union of Pemex. That's why I say a very important reform in the future, and I believe it's part of Plan A, is to go and modernize corporate governance in Pemex.
Well, I think I'm exhausted. Jonathan, I know you have plenty of energy and have something else to say.
Just one last comment on that. I think that if we look at all the different reforms, and there's plenty of them, and things that have to be done in Mexico in terms of the business deregulation and all these types of things, I think if you have to add it up, which one is the most important one, I would not put the energy reform, I wouldn't put the fiscal reform at the top of the list. I would definitely put a truly, really deep labor reform. Introducing flexibility into the labor market is probably the number one problem that we have in Mexico going up ahead. And just to kind of put it in context, Alan Greenspan made the opening statement at the 80th anniversary of the Central Bank in Mexico. And even though he was focusing more on the U.S., he was saying that the best way to deal with supply shocks and any type of shocks in the future is to have labor flexibility, and that he was really he truly believed that the current account deficit in the U.S. wouldn't really represent a major problem because of flexibility in the markets, and he thought that that was probably something that has helped reduce structural unemployment in the U.S. over the last 25 years. You take that into Mexico, and I think that's probably our number one problem in terms of this competitiveness problem. We're losing market with China. In terms of things that are happening on a worldwide basis, we're facing an industrial revolution in the world, globalization, all these types of things, and we truly need labor flexibility to be able to adjust. Our comparative advantages are changing in a dynamic sense all the time, and we're losing a lot of jobs, and the only really way to be able to create jobs is to give the firms the incentive to be able to create it without these huge costs. We truly need labor, true deep labor flexibility in Mexico, and we're not even seeing the surface of that.
Jonathan, thank you. I don't know if any of the invited panelists have a last word. I found this session to be very informational. I mean, there's so much information that came out, and unfortunately, while I agree with Jonathan in terms of the importance of labor reform, I think the problem with Mexico is that it has more than one number one priority. And how do you tackle that when you also factor in the politics, which came out in this session as being a major variable? There's no question that the next president and the next administration have their work cut out for them. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming to CSIS and flying up from your busy schedules. And thank you for attending the session.